Now we're going to get a little history lesson here. In 1942, the South was on the verge of a rebellion. Black men were stockpiling weapons. The notorious agitator Eleanor Roosevelt was traveling around organizing secret clubs of black domestic workers who were going to turn on their white employers. And the slogan was, "Not a maid in the kitchen by Christmas." This wasn't some rumor. This was news reported and discussed across the South. It was real. Except that, of course, it wasn't. Historian Joshua Zeiss recently wrote in Politico about this epidemic of what we now call fake news. And he sat down to discuss it with a fellow historian, New Yorker staff writer Jelani Cobb.
So we've had this conversation now about, you know, the way that our landscape, media landscape, has changed, especially the kind of digital proliferation of rumors and quote-unquote fake news and so on. But this is obviously very far before the internet's existence in 1942. How did this information spread?
Sure. A lot of it spread by word of mouth, but I also did a search of Southern newspapers, as many as I could, that were digitalized, and it was very clear that the larger city dailies were dismissive of the rumors, if not skeptical of them. But a lot of the small-town dailies and weeklies bought into them and affirmed that these rumors were in fact true. They had heard from reliable sources that Eleanor Roosevelt had been at a town nearby organizing black domestic servants, or that it was definitively true based on police reports from nearby sheriffs that African-American men were stockpiling pickaxes and other weapons in expectation of an uprising. So a lot of it was word of mouth, but some of it was also spread through the local media, which is a pretty old tradition in American history.
Mm-hmm. The historian Richard Hofstadter, you know, wrote about this and, you know, famously his essay, "The Paranoid Style of American Politics." And just this is a long tradition of what we would now say describe as conspiracy theories. And he called it the paranoid style, almost as if it was a kind of artistic expression style, like a school of thought. And he makes this interesting point in that essay, too. He says that the early American conspiracies tended to be about kind of subversive elements trying to undermine American democracy from abroad, that the most dangerous elements are there, that you are being corroded from within. I thought that was fascinating, especially if we're looking at what you were talking about in 1942. What made people susceptible to this idea that this was happening or this would happen to them, that there was a black conspiracy afoot in the South?
Well, it's such an important reference because, you know, when Hofstadter was writing, his frame of reference, of course, was the rise of fascism in Europe in the 1930s and McCarthyism in more recent American history. And he looked at these populist movements that oftentimes were so accepting of wild and rife rumor and of a type that were conspiratorial and really improbable on their face. And his point was not that these were aberrations, but that they were deeply ingrained in normative American politics. So when we look at the Comet Pizza incident, you know, of January or December of recently, it seems crazy, but it's got plenty of precedent in American history. And I think part of it is that we see these types of fake news pandemics, so to speak, flare up when America or part of America is undergoing extreme economic or demographic or political change, and it becomes a way for people whose lives are really being upended in ways they have a hard time articulating to explain that change. And that's certainly true of the American South in 1942.
Mm-hmm.
To begin with, a good deal of U.S. War manufacturing was focused in the South. When you suddenly had millions of African Americans participating in a cash economy in war production plants, they didn't get the best jobs, but they got jobs that paid cash and took them out of either a cashless sharecropping or tenant farming economy, or took them out of domestic service into better paying war production jobs. They suddenly enjoyed a certain autonomy, both economic and political, potentially. You know, there was the prospect that they would take these wages and start paying poll taxes, which had been something that was out of reach before. So this is very destabilizing.
And poll taxes is a mechanism that prevented them
from voting. That's right.
From
it
voting.
Prevented many poor whites and blacks in large parts of the South from voting. So there's a lot of There's just a lot of demographic, economic, and political change in the wind, and mm-hmm. it was a situation that was really threatening to the old order.
Mm-hmm. So the FBI was called to investigate these rumors, and what did they find?
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover wanted to prove them. He was no fan of Eleanor Roosevelt's, but they concluded pretty quickly that there was no basis for them. The best that they could figure out was that the rumors about the Eleanor clubs, about black women organizing into clubs, their motto was supposed to be a white woman in every kitchen by 1943, meaning that they were going to completely subvert the South racial order and make domestic servants of their former white employers. Mm-hmm. The rumor was that they were demanding to be called Mrs. or Ms., that they were insisting on entering through the front door rather than the service entrance. They were demanding increases in pay. As best the FBI could figure out, the small kernel of truth behind these rumors was the very real fact that many women in domestic service had a surfeit of options. They could mm-hmm. go and make better money working as cooks or domestic servants in army camps. They could go work in war production plants. So I think on some level, many white people probably did perceive that their formerly, you know, subservient domestic, you know, help were suddenly feeling quite empowered.
And, you know, one of the other things I think that's interesting is the way that this maps onto other kinds of history. Certainly, our history of immigration, we've seen that this conspiratorial thinking has had a kind of correlation to the history of immigration as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the you know, the nativist movement in the 1830s and 1840s, there's a famous episode in right outside of Boston, the Charleston fire incident where a Ursuline convent was burned to the ground. Luckily, no one died, but there were rumors that the nuns inside were sexually torturing, you know, young mm-hmm. Protestant girls. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, this not too far removed from Pizzagate. Mm-hmm. You know, America was rife with rumors in the 1890s and early 1900s, and then again, right after World War I, about Italian and Jewish immigrants,
right.
And they were anarchists and they were socialists and they were, you know, again, deeply embedded in and fifth column type
right.
threat to the mm-hmm. U.S. So, yeah, I think any time we're in this kind of demographic flux, we do tend to see rumor develop into fake news, develop into kind of defining political debate.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a kind of broader thing that I think that's equally troubling here, which is that democracy kind of requires that we take rationality for granted. And we've seen these ideas, irrational, outlandish, false, incredible ideas, gain a significant amount of traction as actually a kind of motive force in people's electoral behavior.
I think that's exactly right. I don't know that this is true of every flare-up of what we, you know, today would call fake news or rumor in American history, but certainly the South in 1942 was the easiest mark for this type of thing. Mm-hmm. It had, you know, a creaky public education system. Only 10% of Southern children who entered the first grade would go on to graduate from high school. Funding for these schools was deeply inadequate. It had a broken political system. Poll taxes and other mechanisms made voter participation rates the lowest in the country, not just among African Americans, but among working class whites as well. There was a kind of lack of a strong civil society. And so I would argue that, you know, it was easier for these rumors to take root and deeper root in the South than in other parts of the country. Today, we clearly do have a disenfranchisement problem in this country, and it takes many forms. There is, you know, the kind of assault on expertise, whether it's on medical and scientific expertise or the assault on journalism and media. It's taken a toll, and so I think Americans are very distrustful of institutions and experts. And when you have such weak civil society institutions, not only do rumors and fake news, so to speak, take root, but I think we also become an easy target for outside. You know, I mean, now I sound like the conspiratorial kind of, you know, like conspiracy theorist I'm talking about, but we do become an easy target for anybody who wants to manipulate that kind of gullibility.
So what really do you kind of divine from this in terms of how we interact with or what we can see from 1942 and say this is pertinent and relevant to how we approach this vastly more complicated media situation, but sharing some of the same parallels in 2017?
I think the bad news, obviously, and you're listening to two historians talk here, is that the historians don't have a magic antidote for these types of ailments. So there's no easy way out. But what's helpful when we can find one or two good historical parallels is not that they're going to show us the way out, but that we can look at the same methodology we apply as we study the rumors in 1942 or in an earlier era. Look at the conclusions we drew from them and see whether those don't offer a starting point today. You know, I can't with any more ease go back to 1942 and fix the American South than I can tell you how we find our way out here. But I think it's a helpful example 75 years later to look at to understand people who were both spreading those rumors and who were the target of those rumors. And then it's really up to, I think, you know, activists and political figures to figure out how to fix those problems.
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb talking with the historian Joshua Zeitz. We've got a link to Zeitz's article in Politico at newyorkerradio.org.